Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 437, titled Counterculture Fascism, being recorded on December 8th of 2003. Sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, more recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, older programs available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the first WFMU address and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website as well. Within a week or so of the airing of each program, there was a detailed article-length description of each For the Record program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Spitfire carries all of the various programs and lectures I've done over the years. They are available on CD. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. I do not get money from the arrangement with Spitfire. As I was digesting the horrible news of September 11th of 2001 on the evening of that fateful day, I was also covering my newspapers from that morning, and there was a grim article that added to the horror of that particular day as I was perusing this. And obviously this is an article that reflects news of the previous days and had nothing to do with September 11th. Yet, I think that it is worth mentioning in this context, because I think that in certain respects at least, perhaps the psychology or some aspects of the psychology of the suicide attackers in those attacks and some of the psychological makeup of killers who commit mass murder and videotape themselves ahead of time have something in common. Specifically, they're both projecting. It's rather like James Cagney in the film White Heat, where in the end he says, you know, look at me, Ma, I'm on top of the world. And whether one is flying an airplane into a building in hopes that one will then be incorporated into heaven and get 70 black-eyed virgins, or whether one is seeking a form of media notoriety that is in and of itself a form of immortality. What psychologists refer to as projection, basically projecting out the personality into a post-mortem incarnation, is one of the things these two mentalities have in common. As I was digesting the horror of the September 11th attacks, I was reading the San Jose Mercury of September 11th, 2001, and the San Jose Mercury News of that date carried an article, Sacramento Killer Vowed Not to Be Taken Alive, authored by Michelle Guido. The subtitle, Gunman's Short, Horrific Life, included fascinations with guns, neo-Nazism, Timothy McVeigh and Charles Manson, and victimization by his mother, according to court records. The article reads in part, agitated, shirtless under his body armor and holding a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, disgruntled security guard Joseph Ferguson stared straight into the video camera held by a man who would shortly become the fifth life snuffed out in Ferguson's 24-hour killing spree. I've taken four victims, unquote, Ferguson said from the Rancho Cordova home where he held a Burns International security colleague and his wife hostage for nearly 18 hours before shooting himself to death in a gun battle with officers. That should be enough to last a week in the news, unquote. And skipping down, more about Ferguson's background. He was a troubled and hateful youth who was molested by his own mother. The court files of his parents' divorce confirms that Susan Ferguson pleaded no contest to 20 counts of unlawful oral copulation. Joseph Ferguson was fascinated with neo-Nazism, Timothy McVeigh, and Charles Manson. With his father's help, he amassed a large arsenal kept in a homemade underground bunker neighbors said was also used as a target range. It might appear to be a far leap for someone to look at political and cultural influences on someone who was obviously a very, very troubled individual. But there are some aspects of counterculture purveyance that actually do extol people like Timothy McVeigh and Charles Manson, and obviously neo-Nazism is something that is part of our political counterculture. And what we're going to look at for the duration of the program is the extent to which certain forms of countercultural expression, in particular music, publishing, performance, art, and also conspiracy theory, or the world of conspiracy theory, can become a vehicle that can be exploited by doctrinaire fascists in order to seduce the unwary. Now, several points to make. First of all, I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing these countercultures necessarily as fascist. Neither the black metal music nor industrial music scenes nor conspiracy research could be construed as fascist. One of the dangers, I think, is that young people in particular, or people who are not particularly well educated, can be seduced by the deliberate confusion that some doctrinaire fascists and or cynics who are simply out to market product without regard for the potential implications of what they're doing. The danger is, I think, that the unwary can be seduced. First of all, adolescents. Young people are vulnerable to all sorts of influences. Adolescence is difficult at best. And when one has a troubled adolescence, as this fellow Joseph Ferguson obviously did, it leaves them vulnerable to the kinds of cultural influences that we're going to be talking about. Most young people don't know anything about fascism. They just haven't been taught about it. They think that fascism is when their parents caught them smoking dope and docked them for 6 months. And so they're not aware of what fascism is really all about. I think, too, with a culture that engages regularly in the big lie, when people become aware of the fact that they are being lied to, it once again leaves them open to seduction by some of the fascist elements within the conspiracy research milieu. When someone becomes aware of the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald did not, in fact, kill President Kennedy, it can leave them in a relativistic political mindset in which they begin asking, well, maybe the Holocaust didn't happen. You know, maybe Hitler was right. Maybe there is a conspiracy of Jewish bankers or the Illuminati or space aliens or reptilian shapeshifters or whatever that is controlling the world. For this reason, I think, it is very important to be quite specific about some of these countercultures and to point out that, in fact, conspiracy research is not fascist. The black metal music scene is not fascist, but that there are elements within both that seek to exploit some of the fascist elements that are present within both in order to seduce people to what is basically a fascist viewpoint. Whether they do this out of ideology or out of cynicism, simply a desire to move their product and to make the sale, is a matter of individuality, I suspect, and not the focal point of this discussion. We're going to be taking a look at a long article authored by the brilliant Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey, and the Postwar Fascist International. I've used many of Kevin's articles and books in the past, and we've spoken many times with Kevin Coogan. This article by Kevin Coogan, which is available on the internet, is called How Black is Black Metal? It was first published in the printed magazine Hit List, which is about music, and the Hit List issue of February and March of 1999. This article is about the book Lords of Chaos, authored by Michael Moynihan, a man who was both a doctrinaire fascist, a magister of the Church of Satan, and someone who was engaged in fascist publishing and writing, and also the dissemination of the fascist various forms of fascist music on the counterculture scene. The point of Kevin Coogan's discussion of this book could be summed up in one of the last paragraphs. And I'm going to read the last couple of paragraphs and then go back to the earlier parts of the article. Lords of Chaos is about the black metal music scene and focuses on some people involved with some church burnings in Norway. And the last couple of paragraphs read, Lords of Chaos, published by Feral House, contains a good deal of fascinating information about both black metal and cultural fascism. But does it all add up? While one could persuasively argue that church burnings per se might well arise from black metal's dime store satanic ethos, Lord of Chaos's musings about fascism and black metal largely hang on a thin evidentiary thread, Varg Vikernes. Yet, when Moynihan replaces his steel helmet with a reporter's fedora, Lords of Chaos shows that Vikernes has been a far-rightist well before he became a black metalist. After his murder of Euronymous, Vikernes almost lost all his credibility in a scene where the old-timers still mourn for the Prince of Death. Lords of Chaos gives an especially clear, even restrained summary of its core thesis in the following paragraph. There are many divergent political views found across the spectrum of black metal musicians and fans. The communism of Euronymous provides a prime example of someone taking leftism to its utmost extreme. But no one will deny that right-wing attitudes have become a natural extension of the interests of some involved. Then Kevin Coogan goes on, but just how many black metal fascists are there? 10? 100? 1,000? Lords of Chaos doesn't tell us. And are these unnamed fascists the natural children of black metal? For all its cleverness in seeking to portray Varg Vikernes as the Charles Manson of the Marilyn Manson generation, Lords of Chaos fails to make a convincing case that black metal and fascism walk hand in hand. And we're going to talk about Lords of Chaos. And note that one of the central points of Kevin Coogan's writing here is that Moynihan's own fascist ideology obviously is at play in his interpretation of what is not a fascist phenomenon, the black metal music scene, and his interpolation of the non-fascist black metal music scene as a fascist phenomenon. This is part of a more complex cultural evolution that I will try to do justice to as I read the bulk of Kevin Coogan's article. But note that the point of this article is that one of the central points is that the black metal music scene is not fascist, but that in the book The Lords of Chaos, published by one of Moynihan's associates, a fellow named Adam Parfrey, who runs Feral House, the publisher of this, author's own political viewpoint, a fascist political viewpoint, has tainted the interpretation of the material, and that it is this ideologically tainted interpretation that is being marketed to the readers of the book. Now, the authors of the book are Michael Moynihan and Diedrich Sederlund, and the focal points of the book are two Norwegian black metal musicians, a fellow named Øystein Arseth, or Euronymous, or Prince of Death, and also Varg Vikernes from the one-man group Barzen. And ultimately, Euronymous was murdered by Varg Vikernes. Skipping down in Kevin Coogan's article, How Black is Black Metal? Lords of Chaos, however, is far less interested in Euronymous than in the man who killed him, Varg Vikernes from the one-man music group Barzum. Vikernes, a church burner who dubbed himself Count Grishnok after an evil ogre in The Lord of the Rings, is now serving a 21-year sentence, Norway's toughest penalty, in a maximum security prison for brutally stabbing Euronymous to death on August 10, 1993. After his arrest just 7 days later, the Count justified himself by claiming that Euronymous was a communist queer who had cheated him out of Barzum royalties. He also claimed that Euronymous was plotting to kill him. After being ostracized from the black metal community, Vikernes announced that he was now no longer a black metal Satanist, but rather a Nazi Odinist because the Jews had, quote, killed my father Odin, unquote. If Lords of Chaos were only about the antics of the most extreme wing of black metal, it would be an informative and entertaining look at pop culture Grand Guignol. The book, however, suggests that the events in Norway reflect a growing tendency among alienated youth from Miami to Moscow who are now allegedly blending black metal, Satanism, and currents of fascism into a culturally explosive Molotov cocktail. Vikernes, however, is really famous for murder, not music. While the overwhelming majority of black metal musicians and fans are not, and are not likely to become church burners, murderers, or Nazi Odinists. To buttress its thesis, Lords of Chaos points to metalheads-turned-murderers including Belphegor from the Swedish satanic band Nefundus, or Nefandus, who attacked a black man in a self-described nigger hunt. Bard Ithun, or Faust, from the Norwegian group Emperor, who murdered a gay man that sought to seduce him. And John Nodvite from the Swedish group Dissection, who butchered an Algerian immigrant. Lords of Chaos even devotes an entire chapter to an obscure two-man German band called Absurd, who coldly executed an annoying fellow high school student. Although the members of Absurd are self-proclaimed Nazis and Vikings fans, even they reported that they committed the crime for personal, not political motives. Lords of Chaos also dwells on the activity of otherwise highly obscure fascist propagandists with no direct ties to black metal, who are nevertheless trying to recruit its followers into their cause. It even adopts a far-right spin on Jungian theory when it suggests that Vikernes may have tapped into an anti-Christian, racial and cultural archetype that is allegedly still aglow in the Norwegian collective unconscious. The book also profiles racist killers with no known ties to black metal, such as the Florida youth clique called the Lords of Chaos, from which the book takes its title. Before being dethroned by local police, the Lords burned down a church, murdered a gay teacher, and were planning to slaughter black visitors to Disney World with silencer-equipped automatic weapons. Lords of Chaos dominates with a pea into the fire, which it claims burns bright inside the black metal underground, despite the attempts of mysterious, unnamed forces of finance and materialism to root it out and stamp it out, unquote. If the jailed murderer Faust is to be believed, however, just the opposite has occurred. In a recent interview in the top Norwegian black metal zine Slayer, Faust complained, "As for the black metal scene, it's not really interesting anymore. I mean, there must be over 100 underground labels releasing albums of every immature, pre-ready band around. I'm amazed about the absence of every little sign of a critical attitude from record labels," unquote. When asked if all this bothered him, Faust replied, "Not really, it's just a normal development. We saw the signs already in 93. As soon as the arrests were made, and when people saw the happenings made, they thought, hey, maybe I can make something out of this too," unquote. If anything, the forces of finance and materialism, unquote, have used the events of 1993 to mass market black metal. Lords of Chaos's publisher, Feral House itself, distributes one of Vikernes' Burzum CDs, Philosophem. Well, Feral House, by the way, has become quite a force on the counterculture publishing scene. Much of their material just deals with one aspect or another of pop culture or arcane culture. They also publish a fair amount of political material as well, a lot of it conspiracy research or a theory. That itself tends to be very uneven, ranging from material that's spot on to material that's utter drivel. But do note that among Feral House's product, again, much of it devoted to various aspects of pop culture, much of it's political, and that alongside of some of the conspiracy research that they publish, they also publish fascist material of one type or another, some of it music, some of it print, and they're the distributors or publish or distribute fascist material. I should have qualified that. They also distribute one of Vikernes' Burzum CDs, Philosophem. Returning now to the black metal music scene, despite its apparent fascination with elements of fascism, Lords of Chaos studiously avoids comparing black metal to white power music, a sound much beloved by real Scandinavian fascists within a certain age group. A longtime leading Norwegian far-rightist named Erik Bleicher, who currently controls a major white power label called Regnarok Records, is only mentioned once in passing in Lords of Chaos. LOC also ignores Norway's right populist Progress Party, which won 25 parliamentary seats in the 1997 elections, with a pumped-up anti-immigrant, anti-welfare state, and anti-LAP platform, even though Vikernes seems to have shared many of its prejudiced beliefs. He even justified murdering Euronymous because he was, quote, half Lappish, a Sami, so that was a bonus, unquote. When it does briefly mention Norway's right, Lords of Chaos admits that the links between the Goose Steppers and the Ghouls are extremely tenuous. Indeed, with its white corpse paint, medieval Viking imagery, and industrial strength angst, black metal seems, if anything, overtly anti-political. Lords of Chaos has been generally perceived as an exposé of a colorful music subculture, and it does indeed provide much valuable information about an otherwise inaccessible scene. Yet what really makes the book fascinating is that its main author, Michael Moynihan, is himself an extreme rightist whose fusion of politics and aesthetic violence shapes a not-so-hidden subcurrent that runs throughout Lords of Chaos. The book itself, however, is not a fascist tract in the strict sense of the term, in part because Moynihan co-wrote the book with Diederik Soderlund, a former music critic for a mainstream Norwegian paper who is now an editor at Playboy. By the way, his name is S-A-D-E-R-L-I-N-D. Continuing. Moreover, Feral House editor Adam Parfrey clearly wanted to publish a popular book on the strange universe of black metal rather than a political polemic. Nor does Moynihan himself fit easily into the more conventional definitions of fascism. Lords of Chaos is best characterized as a palimpsest with the author's own political ideology at work just below the surface of a text ostensibly devoted solely to analyzing an extremist musical subculture. Michael Moynihan is an interesting fellow. Some might argue that he is actually three people: Michael Jenkins, Michael Moynihan Jenkins, and Michael Jenkins Moynihan, since all three monikers have graced his projects. In 1989, the youthful Bostonian joined forces with the San Francisco-based Abraxas Foundation, which he described as an occultist, fascist think tank linked to the Church of Satan. Moynihan dubbed his own wing of the Abraxas Foundation Axis Sanguinaries, or Blood Axis, because, quote, blood can be seen as life, and at the same time it can be equated to death. It is essential to violence in almost all instances. It has powerful sexual connotations. It is the key fluid of history. Axis highlights the genetic aspect of blood, bound together in the will of a people or race. It describes allies of mind and blood mobilized for total warfare. It also reiterates the pivotal nature of blood in human existence, both personal and world historic. According to some reports, Moynihan's blood fetish included drinking non-AIDS-infected blood. He was also suspected of setting fire to a manger scene on the Cambridge Commons just across from Harvard University in 1987. A note left by the firebug at the smoky scene the day after Christmas asked, quote, how many more fires before you realize your gods are dead? Dead, unquote. As for the Abraxas Foundation, it was founded by another blood fetishist named Boyd Rice in 1984. The name came from Abraxas, a Gnostic deity that combined within itself the forces of light and darkness, good and evil. Rice hoped that his foundation would help to create a, quote, a new demographic of people who are into the occult, fascism, and social Darwinism. It's out there as an alternative for kids who are growing up and need that information, unquote. Both Rice and Moynihan came out of the industrial music scene. Rice, who calls his musical project Non, released his first self-produced noise music black album in the late 1970s. As for Moynihan, he created his own one-man power electronics group called Coup de Grâce in 1984. In the summer of 1989, Rice invited him to come to Japan, where Rice was doing a Non tour. Non's the name of his group, by the way. That same year, Moynihan renamed his project Blood Axis. Then turning to one of the groups that helped to pioneer the use of fascist imagery as a vehicle for creating shock, sort of an anti-bourgeois culture shock effect, but not necessarily something that was intended for political indoctrination or fascist in intent. That group is called Throbbing Gristle, and it has some offshoots. Moynihan, describing Throbbing Gristle and attacking them as not being fascists, wrote, "And then you have hypocritical people who use this kind of totalitarian fascist imagery and then claim they're against all the things they're singing about, which has always bothered me. They're using these fascistic totalitarian discipline tactics, and there's an inherent irony in that. The people in these bands use this incredible level of violence and yet claim they're in favor of peace and are opposed to violence. What I liked about the black metal people that I saw right away was that they seemed totally unhypocritical. Because you'll see these other bands like Throbbing Gristle, who are also in a lot of ways using really violent imagery, and ultimately you have someone like Genesis P. Orridge being some hippie flower child in reality." The chain of events that led Moynihan and Rice to an eccentric and avant-garde form of cultural fascism that would have made Hitler himself apoplectic began in the industrial culture movement in the late 1970s, and particularly with the seminal British industrial band Throbbing Gristle. Boyd Rice and Throbbing Gristle played together at Rice's first London concert in 1978, and then again later in Berlin. Throbbing Gristle's industrial records even agreed to release a Boyd Rice LP before he signed up with Mute. Throbbing Gristle and Rice were also lauded by Research in its influential 1983 industrial culture issue. Throbbing Gristle's most important member, Genesis P. Orridge, a pun on General Post Office, legally changed his name from Neil Megson after becoming active in the mall art movement of the early the male art movement of the early 1970s. He also did extreme performance art with his then girlfriend Cosi Fani Tutti under the name COUM Transmissions. Their shows incorporated whipping, self-mutilation, masturbation, enemas, and vomiting. COUM Transmissions lasted until 1976 when Genesis, Cosi, and their friend Sleazy, Peter Christofferson, who had joined COUM in its last year, created Throbbing Gristle with electronics whiz Chris Carter to reach a broader audience. Boyd Rice recalled that when he and GPO first met in London in 1978, "I played Jen an early non-concert tape and he played me an early TG tape. We both agreed that there were some amazing similarities not only in the musical, if you can call it that direction we were exploring, but also on a personal level, a lot of shared interests. I had no idea what TG was when I went around to look up Jen. All I know is that he was an artist who was very into Manson and Hitler. Back then, no one was into that sort of thing. In those days. Jen still wore swastikas and would tell anyone who'd listen and many that wouldn't what a great guy Hitler was. Uncle Adolf, he called him. But that was a long time ago." We're going to continue with this analysis of cultural fascism and the extent to which that has been exploited for political purposes. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a longer URL linked to both that and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed article-length description of For the Record program 437 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 437, Counterculture Fascism, being recorded on December 8, 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.